Tom, you've been now the CEO for 2 months?
Just about, 1st of February.
Okay. Can you give us a little bit of your background?
I've been a lawyer in Washington, D.C., practiced environmental law. During the Clinton administration, I went into government and worked as the chief of staff and chief operating officer at the Department of Interior for Secretary Babbitt. And in that role, worked a lot with Al Gore. So I've spent some time kind of at the knee of the two of the real giants of environmental protection in American history, I think. Learned a lot from those guys. But got to see how issues like the Pebble Mine and the salmon controversy get resolved by government. And then came back to private practice, and in private practice I've worked on 404 permit issues, including two or three of the larger ones in Alaska. I worked on Alpine, which was the first oil well that went into NPRA, and then on the recent CD5 issue here, both of which were fairly controversial. Also worked on the reauthorization of the TAPS pipeline. So I've got a fair amount of Alaska experience, never lived here. I'm enjoying the fact that I've recently moved. My family and I are now residents of Anchorage and really are having a pretty good time learning about the state. So.
For those of us that don't know how these things work so well, John Shively is now the chairman of the board. He's been sort of the face and the voice of the Pebble Project for a number of years. What's the division now between the two of your roles? And who would we expect to see often or in what areas in the future?
Well, you know, I like to think that this is not one person replacing another. This is doubling down, I guess. You're going to see John a lot. I wouldn't have taken this job if John wasn't going to stick around. He's going to be a mentor to me as I learn about some of the issues that I don't know about. But I'm the CEO. I'm the guy who has my hand on the tiller as we move forward. And John, as chairman of the board, is going to be giving me advice and direction, but also is still going to be an important face for our public presentations and so forth.
Okay. Kind of the big news from Pebble this week has been a response filed to the EPA. Can you characterize what Pebble's response was to the EPA before we dive into that a little bit more?
Well, it's a difficult thing to characterize because it covers so many different issues. We believe that the EPA, well, let's start back with what they did to us on February 28th. EPA initiated something called a 404C veto process. So it's a process to determine whether they want to veto the mine, outlaw the mine, before we even file a permit describing what our mine would be like, in other words, laying out our mine plan. This has never been done in the history of the Clean Water Act, 43 years of history. So this is a very unique thing for them to do. And it's a little bit incongruous, because how do you determine whether a specific mine has environmental problems if you don't know what the hell the specific mine plan is? So on the 29th of April, we filed our response to them, explain to them why we think they should not veto this project as we go through the process. And it raises a bunch of legal issues and policy issues and scientific issues. On the legal side, we claim that they don't have authority to issue a preemptive veto under the statute, that the statute is only meant to allow EPA to get involved once an application for a permit has been filed. We also claim that under the Statehood Act and ANILCA, that this particular land was set aside by the federal government for mineral exploration, and that EPA can't come in and withdraw the land unilaterally, as they have threatened to do here. So those are our legal issues. On the policy front, we think that the way you resolve difficult scientific disputes, we claim there's not going to be harm to the fish, and there are others that claim there will be harm to the fish. The way you resolve that difference is that you do a thorough and comprehensive and rigorous environmental impact statement. That's the way it's been done every other time in our country's history. And what EPA is doing here is avoiding that, intentionally avoiding the rigor of an independent scientific environmental impact statement. I'm surprised that the environmental community is supporting that, because the environmental community historically has always argued that you don't make a major decision regarding the environment unless you do an EIS. In fact, you'll recall that the president and the environmental community were arguing that the Keystone Pipeline couldn't be approved until the EIS was completed. Here they're arguing the opposite, and it's inconsistent at best. We think that's bad policy, and that they ought to let us into the process. I mean, I don't know why they're scared to have their science looked at by an independent, rigorous review, but they appear to be. And the real kicker is that no environmental harm will happen while we would go through that process. Can't turn a shovel of dirt on this mine until we get a permit. So why won't EPA simply let us go through the process? So we see this as a due process argument. We think it's an important one. And it's not just us. Every major project in Alaska is now threatened by this process. And some say EPA would never do that. I know I've heard that from a number of people in the environmental community and a number of people in Washington. But we got some documents that show a briefing that was given to Administrator Jackson back in 2010. And what those documents show is that it is exactly EPA's intent to do that. They clearly state that the reason EPA wants to explore this new preemptive veto process is so that they can be in the lead on all 404 permit issues. That's contrary to what the statute says. The statute says it ought to be ought to be the Corps of Engineers in the lead. And second, so that they can determine which watersheds in America are appropriate for development and which aren't. In other words, EPA wants to take on the role of zoning America. Okay. This is crazy. This is way beyond what the statute allows. And this isn't me suspecting that that might be the motive of EPA. This is EPA saying that's what its motive is, all right, in these documents. So those are our policy arguments. Finally, on the policy, one more point, and that is we've invested nearly $700 million getting ready to go into permitting. That's what it costs to get ready for one of these permit processes. All of that money was foreign investment in America. It all came from Canadian companies and from UK companies. Nobody's going to invest that kind of money in America if EPA can come along and say, you don't even get in the process. You don't even get to file your permit, right? So this has huge ramifications. And on the scientific front, they rest their potential veto decision on this watershed assessment that they completed. We believe that EPA had a predetermined result when they did that watershed assessment. There are a bunch of documents that support this. The real smoking gun, though, is a budget, internal budget document in 2010 in EPA. The watershed assessment wasn't published until later, so they didn't have any science yet. And the budget document is asking for money to veto the project. They'd already made up their mind before they did the science. And then when you look at the science, you can see how they are trying to manipulate it to reach the result they wanted. Just a couple of examples. One is EPA admits that technology today is good enough to capture all wastewater that touches a mine site. Okay, so rain comes down, water that we use, other things, has to be captured and then treated before it's released. Notwithstanding the fact that they say that technology would allow you to capture it all, they assume, without any stated reason, that 50% of the water would somehow escape this capture and be released into the system. No reason, no rationale, they just assume it. That's not what science is today. All over America, people are capturing wastewater and treating it and relying upon that treatment. Second thing, we use a lot of water in our mining process, and then we release that water. And the question is, when do we release it, how do we release it, where do we release it? And it has an impact on fish, obviously. And so what they did was model how we would release this water into the various streams. There are three creeks, so there are three possibilities. they assumed that they would release 50% of the water into one creek, 50% into another creek, and none into the third creek. Well, the reason they made that assumption, illogical assumption, is that that's the assumption that shows the most damage to the fish. Okay, so they didn't assume one-third, 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 and much less look at, there are some very sophisticated models that have been created by the Fish and Wildlife Service that determine not just where you release it, but when you release it, and how much you release at certain times of the year, et cetera, et cetera. When you use those models, it shows no impact to the fish. They intentionally used an approach to show damage to the fish. So back to the fact that we didn't submit a mine plan, they had to assume a plan. They assumed a plan that would do the most damage, and then they say, oh my gosh, there's damage, right? So we think the result was predetermined to come out bad. So in sum, we've raised a lot of issues. And the interesting thing about all the issues we've raised is that if EPA would simply back off of its veto now, let us file a permit, have an environmental impact statement done, they've still got their right to come in and veto at that point if they so choose. But at least we've had good science, rigorous science, third-party reviewed science. We'd be following the process that's been used in every other circumstance in America, and we wouldn't be setting these dangerous precedents that EPA can come in and kill every major development project in Alaska.
You mentioned that EPA would still have a chance to review the project and to veto it. Maybe explain where they would come in on this. Pebble says somewhere between 50 and 100 maybe permits would be necessary by the time a shovel turns.
Yeah.
When is EPA's normal role in a process of a mine like this?
Most of the time EPA comes in, well, first of all, there are a bunch of permits you have to get. 50 to 100 is a good estimate. But the king of the permits, the real key, is this Section 404 permit that is granted or denied by the Corps of Engineers. And that's the one that EPA has the statutory authority to veto. But the way the statute is set up and the way the process has usually worked is that after an environmental impact statement has been completed, EPA will at that time determine whether or not it wants to initiate a veto process. So it would be downstream 3 or 4 years here, and that's when they can come in and make their decision. The reason we want them to make their decision then instead of now is that there's a huge difference, and that is an environmental impact statement will have been completed. Rigorous, comprehensive, independent look at the science.
Sure. Now, they or some other critics say, you know what, we'll save the mining companies the effort and we'll just veto it now. We'll put the protections in place. We'll save you the money and the effort because we know it's not going to exist. What do you say to those folks?
It's our money. If we want to spend it and risk it, we'll spend it and risk it. EPA doesn't have the right to tell me whether I want to invest in something or pursue it like that. To say that they're saving us from ourselves is baloney, and I think there are a few other words I could have used, actually. What they're really doing, I believe, is that they don't want their science to be subjected to that independent review.
The science that's already been done or the
Their watershed assessment that's been done won't withstand the rigor of an environmental impact statement, and that's why they want to move now.
Now, a lot of folks, and you mentioned the environmental groups earlier, you're surprised that they would support what's been done so far. They say the EPA got the science right. Some others say the EPA didn't really do much of their own science at all. Pebble has now spent 8 years and $120-some-odd million, according to the company, doing its own science. What does Pebble view the EPA's work so far as being? Is it a scientific document, the watershed assessment?
Well, they've done some of their own science, and they've relied on a lot of other science that has been done, a lot of papers and studies and things. But interestingly, they have only relied, they decided they wanted to do peer reviews of 7 studies that kind of served as the core of their watershed assessment. All 7 of those studies had been prepared or supported by people that have been known opponents of the project. None of the studies that were out there that supported the project were chosen to be peer reviewed. The peer reviews that came back were quite critical of those studies, and yet they continued to rely on them. Some of them saying that the studies exhibited bias, and yet they still relied on them. The ENGOs say that this is a good scientific document. They have yet to respond to the specific criticisms that we have laid out in this letter and have laid out before. It's one thing just to say, yes, it's good science. It's another to explain why it is the EPA chose in their water release model to release the water in such a way that it would have the most damage to the fish instead of many other options that they had. That shows bias. That's not good science. And the ENGOs and EPA haven't responded to that yet.
Okay. Article out in the Washington Times by one of their investigative reporters, the name, I believe, Philip Swartz, published at the end of April here, suggests that he's got copies of emails between EPA officials talking about the merit of vetoing. Let me just read it. This is from EPA official Philip North, wrote in an email in the summer of 2009, quote, "As you know, I feel both of these projects, Chewitna and Pebble, merit consideration of a 404C veto." That is apparently at least 2 years before EPA officially announced they would undertake the review. Pebble concerned about this?
Yeah, we've actually been aware of these emails for some time now. And months ago, we requested the Inspector General, the COP at EPA, to conduct an independent investigation into these emails and a bunch of others. So far, that remains under consideration. I remain hopeful that the Inspector General will, in fact, open an investigation to determine whether or not folks at EPA had prejudged, in other words, began in 2008 with a goal to kill this project and simply went through the motions and manipulated the process to accomplish that goal. It looks to us like that's what the case was when you look at all these emails. And we have hundreds of emails. I noticed in that same article a statement by EPA that said something to the effect that, yes, there are some emails, but this is a big organization and these are fairly low-level people in the organization. But I suggest to you, when you see the enormous number of such emails and the constant effort, that this is not just a rogue employee or two or three. This is something that could not have escaped the eyes of management unless management was intentionally turning their eyes away from this. These folks were out there communicating on a regular basis. They were meeting with other agencies of government. They were meeting with ENGOs. This was a big effort. This was not something that was just kind of being done on the sly.
Are you've been around government. Are you confident that an investigation would be done into this behavior to show whether or not the EPA has acted appropriately? Or is this something you say for litigation in the future?
Tough question. Let me first say that for the time I've spent in government, I've spent 2 3-year stints in government at two different agencies. I never saw anything like this. I was shocked when I saw these emails, completely shocked. I am surprised that the leaders of EPA aren't also shocked and haven't responded in some way to all of these documents that have been put out. I'm clearly surprised at that. Second, if there is any fairness out there, the Inspector General will open an investigation into this and do a thorough investigation. That's his job and that's his role. If he doesn't do an investigation, I believe there are congressional committees that will do an investigation, and I think they will investigate not only these underlying documents, but why the Inspector General didn't do an investigation. And then ultimately, if that doesn't come out there, this will be if EPA follows through with this process and initiates some kind of final action against the Pebble mine, this will be the centerpiece of the litigation that we'll file to overturn that. But I don't think it'll get there. I think that this will be dealt with before then.
It seems like Pebble has responded to each direction that the EPA has taken this process. Are you at the whim of the EPA, and is the matter in your hands anymore, or do you just need to let this process play out until you have your next move?
Well, you know, anytime you're in a regulatory process, the agency has control over the process.
But it seems like they're they're setting up a regulatory process that's fairly innovative and new.
Absolutely. That's where I was headed. The difference here is that this is a process that's never been, I mean, there's a well-worn process that every development that needed a permit in America has been down, and now EPA is charting a different and new course. And so to some extent, yes, we are at their whim. But we still have control over the fact that that we're responding aggressively to what they're doing. We filed our letter. It's a powerful letter, and I think should give EPA pause in terms of the direction that they're headed. We have a request into the Inspector General that they investigate the fact that that this conduct by EPA was subversive. It subverted the process. And we are considering filing litigation on these points about EPA not having legal authority to undertake this process to begin with. So we're in control of those three things. We're moving those things ahead. And to some extent, now the ball's in EPA's court, but we're prepared to bat it back if necessary.
Okay. Kind of moving aside from the EPA, but as far as Pebble goes, this has certainly taken its toll. It seems to have taken its toll on investors for the project. Certainly seems to have taken its toll on the timeline for the project. Can you comment to that? Is Pebble still moving forward with the confidence of the investors and recruiting investors? And will the public ever see progress towards a mine plan and permitting?
We're ready to file a permit. We have a plan that we're pretty confident in. But we've got one big question mark, and that is we're also in negotiations or discussions at this point with a handful of major mining companies to step in and become our partner. That new partner will need to look at our plan, and I suspect we'll make several changes to it before we file our ultimate permit. So while if we were totally ready to go, if we had a partner today, we got a plan we could move with. We think we've got to wait till we have our new partner on board so that they can review and modify that plan before we go ahead. Just a side note, again, this explains the craziness of EPA trying to look at our mine plan that they think we're going to build when we don't even yet know what it's going to be, because we've got to wait till we have a new partner that will probably modify it. But be as it may, once we have a new partner, we think we'll be able to move pretty quickly and want to move pretty quickly. The partner process is going along fairly well, notwithstanding EPA's issues. This is a project that is seen by the mining community as a real prize and one that people remain interested in. And we're confident we're going to find a partner and we're going to be able to make the changes to our existing mine plan and get into permitting in the near future. Can't give you a date. You know, I really hope that when the next season opens
next year,
we're you know, in the saddle and ready to move forward with the work that would be necessary on the site to support permitting.
We'll come back to the season here in just a minute. I'd like to talk about jobs with you in a bit. As you talk to these potential investors and you're looking at mineral markets around the world, what value is that mine currently sitting at? Is the deposit currently sitting at that Pebble's aware of? Has it changed?
You know, it changes with forecasts on a daily basis, and I don't even keep up with it, I must tell you. To speculate what gold and copper are going to be worth in 10 to 12 years when this mine might start producing, you know, if I could do that, I wouldn't be working every day. I'd be investing only. So,
do you see a lifetime value that of the deposit?
No, okay. I don't know what those numbers would be.
Former CEO John Shively was fond or quoted often as saying, if it's a choice between fish and minerals at this site, fish win. We're about 6 weeks away here from the start of the largest sockeye salmon fishery in the world. 51% or so of the world's wild-caught sockeye coming right into the headwaters of the mine. Your thoughts?
First of all, they don't come into the headwaters of the mine. I don't know whether you've been up there or not, but the headwaters up there are about 3 inches apart, wide. Aren't a lot of salmon in those headwaters. I agree completely with John's statement. If it comes down to choosing fish or the mine, the fish win. Let me also say that under the regular 404 permitting process, we can't get a permit if we're going to kill the fish. That's the way the statute works. So stopping us from going through a process that we can't get through if we're going to kill the fish, it doesn't make sense to me. That's what the process is all about, is to protect the fish. But the interesting thing to me is, you know, I'm new to this. I'm learning a lot of stuff. I realize, particularly in the community that you serve, there's a lot of resistance to our project. And the resistance is primarily because people are concerned we're going to kill the fish. But when I ask them how we're going to kill the fish, they don't have an answer. I don't think people have really peeled back that first question. Someone they trust has told them it's going to kill the fish, and they believed it. What we want to do is to put that issue into the rigor of an independent environmental impact statement and see what comes out of it. And we're not suggesting that EPA go away. We're just suggesting that they wait until that's done. They're still going to be there. They can still veto the project, all right?
Would you be $700 million invested into this project if you thought you were going to need to take a percentage of sockeye out of the fishery or cause a certain amount of harm that would need to be covered up, spoken of, or something like that? Would this have already been derailed?
Of course.
What does your mind plan suggest? Will there be loss of sockeye habitat or of salmon habitat? Maybe you can explain.
0.5 of 1%.
Of the Bristol Bay wide?
Of the two river watersheds that we are in.
Nooshiegak and Kwajalleq?
Yeah, 0.5 of 1%.
Okay. Clean water is another very important part of this aspect. People are very concerned about leaching of minerals that could wreak havoc on wildlife or fish. Part two of that is the idea of a massive tailings facility that may store toxic water forever. Where's Pebble at with this?
Well, let's start with the second question. What's stored in the tailings facility is sand. Okay, it's not a sludge. It's not toxic. It has in it some of the minerals that are in the rock that was there, and it's been pulverized into sand. So this isn't, a lot of people think of a gold mine, and they think of the old days of a heap leach pit mine where cyanide is poured over outdoors over a big part of rock and that can escape and run away. And that's stored in a tailings facility. That's not what we have here. I don't think the people in your community are going to trust the word of the CEO of Pebble on that issue. I'm not out there trying to defend the science of this mine at this point. What I'm trying to talk about is process, right? Let's get into an environmental impact statement. Let's have the best scientists in the world look at this issue and talk about it. That's what'll happen with an EIS. The Corps of Engineers, a government agency, will select an independent third party. They'll get the best scientists they can to look at all the scientific papers, to look at our plan, and they will express their opinion on whether or not this tailings facility is dangerous. We don't think it is. If we thought there was a substantial risk in this tailings facility, we wouldn't be building it.
What about discharge?
Same. You know, we believe we're going to capture 100% of the water that touches our mine site, period. And it'll go through a treatment facility and then be released back into the environment.
It's often been cited that the EPA or other critics are basing their criticisms on 20th century facilities. Can you point to something that is 21st century technology or an operation in the world that people could reference? You've seen behind the curtain of what Pebble intends to do. What can you point us towards? Red Dog, something else?
Red Dog is an example. I think the best examples are several mines that are along the Fraser River in British Columbia. And the reason that I think they're such a good analogy is the Fraser River is another huge salmon highway. And there are two or three mines there that have been in existence for a long time, and there's been no significant damage to the salmon there. Interestingly, those mines are much closer to the Fraser River than we would be to the Bristol Bay, and still no significant problems. But even those mines are 30 to 50 years old. This is going to be the most technologically advanced mine ever built.
Pebble.
Yeah.
Let me jump back.
Let me stay just a second with that. And that is, this issue of looking at old mines and extrapolating that experience to today, I think the analogy is if you wanted to determine the safety of airbags in automobiles, you wouldn't put yourself in a Model T Ford and see how they work, all right? You got to look at the modern technology. And I appreciate people need to be skeptical of modern technology, but that's why you go through this thorough EIS process. One example of that is the watershed assessment found over 200 dams that have failed across the world. But a center line construction dam, which is the kind we're talking about building, built in a first world country under modern regulatory regimes, has never failed. Right? Never failed. And so I think you just have to get to some of the specifics. One of the problems EPA has had in its report of getting to these specifics is they haven't had our mine plan in front of them, so they don't know what we're talking about building. Just another reason why we ought to wait for this EIS.
Anglo-American left the partnership back last fall. Rio Tinto was divested itself and donated its shares to two organizations, charitable organizations. Those are two very major mining companies in the world. You mentioned five or six others. One of the criticisms was if you lose a partner like Anglo-American, you may get another company that doesn't have the track record of environmental concern, human rights, employment, and such as a partner like Anglo. Who may be a potential partner?
Can't give you names. There are all kinds of securities and confidential and other reasons why I can't do that. I wish I
but
could.
But discussions are underway with some?
We're engaged in discussions with a handful of companies, and there's not a single one that would raise the concern that you're talking about.
Do we know what size of investment joining the partnership is now at this point? Anglo left $500 or $600 million on the table when they left.
Yeah. Well, we're open to discussions. I suspect that the deal that will be ultimately worked out will be quite similar to the deal that was worked out with Anglo.
Northern Dynasty's stock prices have kind of done a roller coaster a bit down this month, this week, down in the 70, 80 cents range, I think. Do they have the backing, the financial wherewithal to continue this project for a certain amount of time alone without a partner?
We do. We've got the cash in hand to get through to having a new partner. And should for some reason that be delayed, we've also got the ability to seek financing. And can do that if we need to, and are pretty confident that we can do that. Our preference is to roll right into a new partner, and that's what we're focused on at this point. But there are other options, and there's no problem with us having the money to keep this thing going until we find ourselves a new partner, and to continue the battle with EPA until that time.
You have two kind of interesting new partners that when Rio divested, holding each roughly $10 million worth of stock, or somewhere around there, 8, 9, or 10 million shares anyway. One is the Bristol Bay Native Corporation's Education Foundation. Another is a charitable organization that donates out to many projects around the state. One has told us they'd like to be a passive investor. Another has said they hadn't figured out what type of investor they'd like to be. The last time we spoke with Northern, they said we haven't had any contact yet. Has that changed?
We have had just a little bit of initial contact, nothing formal yet at all, but a phone call or two.
Okay.
And We're pleased to have both of these folks as investors in our project and are looking forward to working with them as we go forward. I know they've got some important decisions to make. Those clearly aren't decisions for us to make or even for us to influence. They're theirs. We are ready and available to give them our views on things, and we welcome their views as major stockholders in our mine. But I think this is a spectacular opportunity for both of these foundations. And if they handle it right, I think it will be something that will inure to the benefit of students in this region to get education and people in Alaska that have other needs that the other foundation meets with its grants. So,
Pebble has long stated, and another talking point of former CEO Shively, that this project will benefit the people of the region, not harm the people. A number of jobs have been created in the past. Tell me your view on the future of this region with a mine.
Hugely different. You know, the hardest part of my new tenure as CEO has been visiting the communities and talking to the people that lost their jobs because of Anglo's withdrawal and our need to pull back. And the single most difficult of those meetings was with the gentleman that is the superintendent of the Lake and Penborough School District, as he looks at, you know, what has happened to the schools he's had to close over the last few years, even with us being in the region, and now without us, the schools that are on the bubble and may have to close next year, and the reduction in his funding and so forth. It is a heart-wrenching situation, and without question the most difficult meeting that I've had since I've been CEO. Providing well-paying jobs for this region and the community writ large, I think, is one of the single major benefits of this project. And it's also training. Just yesterday in some meetings I had in the region, one of the things I really hadn't considered was that even those folks that had worked for us the last several years that no longer had a job with us because we had to cut back, were able to find jobs elsewhere because of the training they got working for us. So it's had a benefit even to the folks we had to let go. But there are lots of other benefits too. And I think first among them is energy.
Talk about that.
We got to bring power in to run this mine.
How much?
I don't know the numbers. I'm sorry. But it's a lot. And you know, it's our plan to bring in enough to make sure there'll be, you know, reasonably costed energy available to this region, and it's not now. I'm surprised that that's not something that people are screaming about. It just seems to me like it would change the life here enormously, and particularly the commercial fishery that is so adamantly opposed, or a great deal of it opposed to what we're talking about. What this could do for fish prices is astounding. If there was reasonably priced energy available to make ice, I mean, you look around here and you clearly see that the price of a salmon in Bristol Bay is nowhere near what it is in other regions around the state. And the reason is the cost of energy. And this project could solve that and change the quality of life for a lot of people here, especially the commercial fishery.
Where do you see power stretch out to?
You know, we haven't gotten to the to the specifics of it, but here's what we do know. We're going to bring power into the mine, and it's going to be located close enough that that power can be made available to the region.
Okay, so nothing's on paper yet.
Not at all. And in fact, you know, what we're open to are suggestions and proposals and other things from the region and from the state. You know, we think this is an enormous opportunity.
Do you have a source of power in mind?
We're still considering several options. There are all kinds of options. There's LNG, there's natural gas pipeline as the two major options, and we just haven't come down yet on what it is we think makes the most sense.
But it would be something probably generated on site, near?
Several options, on site, near, distance away where we generate electricity and take the electricity up by way. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to do this. But the point is, the fact that they're under discussion, I mean, now's the time. Now's the time for the region to step up and pursue the opportunity that is available. And we just don't see the interest. Now, maybe to some extent this is our issue, because since we haven't had a specific plan, we've been a little hesitant to talk about bringing power to the region, because we get the questions you just asked me and we don't have answers to them yet. But it's time for us to engage in that discussion. And the fact that we're going to bring power to this region, if we build this mine, is unmistakable. And it's time for us to start a discussion about the extent to which the region sees that as an opportunity and as an advantage, and how we make that work. And it needs to be a three-way discussion, us, the region, and the state.
Okay. This year seems like it's going to be a pretty slow year on site. Can you tell me about the operations at the Pebble site and in Iliamna? Do you have people employed working this year?
Yeah, very few. We're not doing anything except what we have to do to deal with required environmental reporting and to keep the site safe and steady. For us to start up again, we hope, next year.
Okay. When you do start up again, tell us what this preemptive work looks like.
You know, it's back to doing the same kind of thing that we were doing before. It's continuing our aggressive environmental studies and data collecting, may or may not be putting a hole or two around to figure out where a road might go or that kind of stuff. But it's all work that's directly related to getting the information we need to do a permit. Nothing of any significance in terms of environmental impact or damage, but it would be something that would require us to gear back up, probably not to the levels we were at when we closed down when Anglo withdrew, but in that ballpark.
Okay. Environmental work is nearing complete, or was that put on hold as well? The baseline document has been published. What about the follow-on environmental studies?
We continue to collect some data. But not as robustly as we were before, and we'd like to crank that back up again when we have a new partner.
Have you ever seen this amount of money and time spent towards an environmental study?
I've seen a lot of these. That was my legal work before I took this job, and I've never seen one that comes close to this. I have reason to believe that more environmental data has been collected for this project than any other project in the world.
It's still debated as being bought and paid for science. What? How do you
it's
respond
not science,
to that?
It's data. Big difference, okay? Big difference. We're not selling the assessment of a scientist of the meaning of this data. We're just counting fish. I joke with our fish biologists that they know the name of every fish that's in the region. But the important thing to know is how many of what species are in the river at what times of the year, and are they spawning, or are they, you know, what's going on, and what's the water flow in these rivers, and when are they dry, and when are they not, and that's important for lots of reasons. It's important for determining the impact of our mining operation. It's also important when you look at potential mitigation. We think there are enormous mitigation opportunities in this region because of water flow. There are streams out there that don't support spawning because they don't have enough water flowing at the right speed at the right times of the year. We can fix that. So there are some big opportunities, but the beginning point is counting. It's knowing what the information is, and that's what this is. This is a collection of data, and it's verifiable. I mean, if you don't think that our count in a certain river is accurate, go out there tomorrow and count it yourself and see. You'll see it's the exact same number that we've suggested it is. So.
Reclamation is another topic. Doesn't get discussed much, but it's a requirement at every mine in the state,
right?
I believe. From one shovel of earth to a giant pit seems to be pretty important. What's Pebble planning for reclamation-wise in the future?
Well, you know, this mine will be in operation for a lengthy period of time, but our plan is to reclaim the land so that when you look at it, you're not going to see that there was a mine there.
When the mining operations have ceased, or as underground caving methods?
Well, there are several opportunities to do this. The permit that we're requesting is for an open pit mine, and that's as far as we're going to go today. If that's where this ends, that open pit would be reclaimed. That would be the end of it. Should we decide at the end of that time and have a track record that supports it to request another permit to do some additional work, perhaps some block caving work, then reclamation would need to be done for that also. A little bit easier to do because of the way the mining is occurs. It's also easier to do block caving after you've done an open pit. So all of this goes into the formulation. But the requirement of reclamation is not only one that is imposed on us, it's one that we gladly accept. It's our plan and goal is to reclaim the land as the statutes and regulations require.
Let me ask you another question about a criticism along those lines, which is, if Pebble goes in and the infrastructure follows, infrastructure is implemented, other mining claims in the same area will soon follow. People talk of a mining district.
Right.
Your thoughts on this? Is that concerning to you? Obviously, you can have control over what Pebble does and the effects it. But what if there's 20 mines here in the next 30 years? Are you concerned about that?
Well, you know, every mine that has to come in has to go through the same process that we do. And so if that mine can show that its cumulative impact to the region, in other words, the impact that we've made added to the impact that they'll make, is not something that is significant enough to prevent the mine from getting a permit, then it gets a permit. Could be at some point that that there's a tipping point that's reached and the government ought to stop issuing permits. But right now, you know, the only one that's there is ours. And that needs to be looked at by itself to determine what its impact is going to be. And if there's a concern of future impacts, we ought to deal with that as those projects are suggested.
Two more questions. Pebble is now fighting many fronts to keep this project afloat locally, state regulations, state ballot measures, now federal. We're seeing allies pop up and opposition pop up in new locations all the time. Where do you as the new CEO take the battle daily or weekly? What's your goal of a week?
Well, I've got a pretty clear set of priorities. My first priority is to find us a new partner. My second priority is to get us into permitting. And to get us into permitting, I've got to convince EPA that they're on a wrong approach right now. So that's my goal. Now that requires me to juggle a lot of balls every day. I'm lucky enough to have a quite lean but very talented team that does a great job. But that's what we're focused on pretty intensely right now.
Last question, your message for this Bristol Bay region? Seems like you'll need to have a partner with the majority of folks here if this mine goes forward. What's your message now?
My message today is a real simple one, and that is I don't know enough about why you're so concerned. I want to learn. So I'm here today mostly to listen and to hear what the concerns of this community are and the people who live in this community. And then I want to learn a little bit more about those concerns and come back and have another discussion.
We can expect to see you again?
I'm going to be here a lot. I'll come back and see you.
We welcome you anytime. And Tom Collier, new CEO at the Pebble Limited Partnership, we thank you very much for stopping by.
Sure. Thank you.